Great privilege it is to worship together with this congregation. I hope you're thankful and aware. Let's not take it for granted. We have a special privilege, I think, of working with this eldership. All of us do, and we have an added responsibility. You're not a spectator, and I'm not a spectator. We're all involved, I hope, and dedicated to a task that Jimmy mentioned as being worldwide, and we're thankful for that privilege. We have many visitors here again today, and we're glad to have you. Always we're glad. We hope you'll come back and be with us. We hope you'll be blessed by having come today. The first and only time I've ever spoken on this subject, I came away from the service wondering about its value and the effectiveness of it. I don't think I understood really the purpose for which I had spoken on it. Sometimes that happens, you wonder, well, why in the world did I ever speak on that? And last week we announced that would be the subject for last Sunday morning sermon. But you notice that we changed it and spoke on another subject related to this, but one that I felt like I could get a hold of. So here I am again. I'm going to speak on this subject if it kills me. I'm going to speak on law before law. I feel like the man that was preaching on the statement, "Behold, I come quickly," and the young man that was, and he said, "Behold, I come quickly," and he couldn't think of what came next, and he started back and said, "Behold, I come quickly," and he still couldn't think. He said, "Behold, I come quickly," and about that time the podium went over and he landed right in the lap of this old lady on the front row, and he said, "Oh, my dear, excuse me." She said, "That's all right, son, you warned me 3 times. So here we go again. I'm going to speak on this subject today. We've been looking lately at the subject of morality. On June the 9th, we talked about 3 planes of morality: animal, slave, and free son. And we discussed the means by which you develop morality in the lives of young Christians and old. Then last Sunday morning, we noticed 3 kinds of morality, or 3 kinds of living, or 3 planes of living. 3 laws, you might call them, rules, the iron rule, that was manifested by the thieves, the silver rule, that which was manifested by the priest and Levite, and then the golden rule, that was exhibited by the Good Samaritan. We told the parable of the Good Samaritan and drew out of it these 3 codes or laws of living. Today, I want to discuss with you another subject that centers around this development of morality. I hope I can get across to you what is necessary. I feel like that what is said today will be important. I want to approach the subject of the development of morality on a comprehensive, more or less a broad, comprehensive scope. We find ourselves today living in a very lawless age. And all of that I'm going to be saying today and next Sunday and perhaps the next will be said in an attempt to prepare us for a series of lessons in the fall on the development of morality, or in the coming to a maturity in the Christian life. And we need this. We're living in a lawless time. We're living in a very immoral age. And I say immoral even to the point almost of being amoral. It's beyond, perhaps, with some people, that of being a rebellion against morals. They've come to the place, many people have, that they don't even recognize any morals. They recognize no standard. They find themselves in the world like natural animals, even below the natural animal level, because they've rejected even any kind of a code of ethics at all, to where they actually have no real concept at all of what's right and what's wrong. They've been robbed of that. And we've contributed to it. I say we have. I think America has contributed to it. The Watergate morals are something that today I think are less and less the exception and more the rule of the conduct of a lot of people's lives. And we in America have witnessed a tragedy. We've witnessed a time when people are calling good evil, and they're calling evil good. And Isaiah predicted that, and predicted that there's a curse placed upon any nation that would call evil good and good evil. And we're doing that. We're witnessing a time today when we are allowing atheistic fools to make a fool out of America. And we are paying the salaries of idiots. And we pay them these salaries to stand in the podiums of our secular education and our higher institutions of learning and mock us and spit in our face and ridicule us, destroy our foundations, rob us of our heritage, strip away from us the awareness of God in our educational process. All of this, you see, we endorse in the sense that America has contributed to it. She is instigating it. She is seeing to it that it goes smoothly, and the whole thing is destroying a whole generation of people, not in age-wise, but a whole gamut or a whole what you would call a spectrum. There's a whole spectrum of our society that is reaping the consequences, and they're being ripped off by atheistic, and you'll pardon me, but God has described these people as fools, by idiots who think themselves to be wise. The recent Arkansas decision that would, by the report that I get, would forbid the possession even with the intent of reading the Bible by a teacher in the schoolroom. That's tragic. The recent seminar that was conducted on the Harding campus, though, on teaching the Bible in public schools, that was heartening. And people are calling us back to what has been known for hundreds of years as the Hebrew Christian ethic. And they're saying we've got to get back to the Hebrew Christian ethic if we're going to survive. People who are not even Christians are pointing us back to that code of ethics that has made America great. And America was great because America was good. And America was good because America was based upon a concept of God and upon a very high and elevated concept of morality. And to the degree that America forgets God and abandons that code of morality, to that degree will America disintegrate. And we're nearing the 200-year mark within a couple of years. And the average time for a nation to excel and survive in all of the histories of the world is 200 years. That's the average. Because of these things, I want to develop with you and talk to you this morning about some concepts that I think are absolutely essential to our maintaining our morality, or perhaps regaining it. I want to lay some groundwork, and that's about what this will be today. Nobody really likes to lay a foundation. We would really rather just go on. You don't really like to do preparatory work in painting. You'd really rather just go on and slap the paint on it, you know, make it look real good. I would prefer really not to go into this subject this morning. I'd rather go on and talk about other things, but I think we need it. There are two things that are absolutely basic to the maintaining, to the obtaining and maintaining an elevating morality. One is an awareness of God. Number two is an acceptance of a tangible code of ethics. Without both of these, you're not going to have any real meaningful morality by which to live your life. A concept of God, or an awareness of God, and a tangible code of ethics. These two things are absolutely essential. And yet in America, we've been taught that God is dead and that every living or everything in the way of morals is relative. God is dead and morals are relative. By those two very simple strokes, those who would drive us into perdition have successfully robbed us of the two pillars upon which a really moral or morally excellent life can be built. But first of all, as we talk about the existence or the awareness of God and the acceptance of a tangible code of ethics, let me just say this and give this as background. The law of Moses provided this dual concept for the Hebrew people. It provided an awareness and a knowledge of God, and it provided a tangible code of ethics by which to pattern their lives. The Ten Commandments, given in Exodus 20, is the core of that revelation of God to the Hebrew people. Now, I realize that in the book, in Matthew 22, and throughout the Old Testament, even and the New, there was another law, love God and love your fellow man, and that upon these two, the Ten Commandment law and all the prophets and everything else hung, and I'm aware of that. We'll come to that later. But I'm saying that the Ten Commandment law provided for the Jewish people both an awareness of God and a tangible code of ethics. The Ten Commandments are found, of course, in Exodus, the 20th chapter. Let me just very briefly read them. I am the Lord your God that brought you up out of Egypt. And then he said, you shall not have any other gods before me. And then he says that you shall not make unto yourself any graven image. And then you shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. Honor your father and mother. You shall not kill. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. And you shall not covet. This, in very brief statement, is the Ten Commandment law. This was what was given to the Jewish people, and it was and is, I think, correctly referred to as the moral law. This is the basic and this is the heart of the moral code of the Hebrew people. Then there was a whole system of supplementary laws that were the detailed implementation of this Ten Commandment law into the lives and into every facet of the lives of the Hebrew people. And it was a massive accumulation or a massive compilation of the revelation of God to these Jewish people. It contained ceremonial laws telling them how to offer up their sacrifices. It told about the priesthood and what all was required of them. It told about the temple or tabernacle worship. It told so many things. The ceremonial law, which in another sense gave them an awareness of sin and gave them a sense of a reminder of it year after year, without which awareness of sin, a man cannot be healthy in his thinking. Contrary to what modern psychology may think, you've got to have an awareness of sin. And the law also provided a sense of escape or relief from that. All of this was contained in the sacrificial part of the law, this supplementary law that was given at the time of the law of Moses. There was civil, social laws given. This contained such things as, an intricate court system, a system of jurisprudence that is second to none even today. Laws of liability, responsibility through liability, what was required of you. Property rights, the laws regarding the transfer of property and the limitations of where the property could be transferred to and who could own it. It had to be kept within certain bounds of the tribal ownership. And all of this was contained in this supplementary law. Then they had what you might call a Department of Health, Education, and Welfare that regulated sewage disposal. It regulated and imposed quarantine. It provided for an apprentice system to maintain their economy. And it took care of the care of widows and orphans. All of this, you see, was wrapped up and involved in this revelation that you might call the supplementary law that God gave in conjunction with the moral law of the Ten Commandments to the Jewish people. Consequently, the Hebrews had a definite advantage over the Gentile nations because of this supreme excellence of the moral and supplementary, sacrificial, civil, all this law that God had given to the Hebrew people. They had an advantage. In the third chapter of Romans, Paul says, what is the advantage of being a Jew? He said, much in every way. To begin with, he said, they have the law or the oracles of God. And then in chapter 9, he talked about how that they are Israelites. Theirs is the sonship and the covenants and the giving of the law and the worship and the promises and the patriarchs. He said all of these things belong to the Hebrew nation. He says they are at an advantage. They were at an advantage. At least they had the reason to be at an advantage. Their morals should have been far beyond that of the Gentile nations. And yet they weren't. In the Roman letter, chapter 2, again, Paul shows how that these people had missed the point and how that they had deteriorated in their morals to the fact or to the point that they were actually they were a curse upon the name of God. They were a reproach. You call yourself a Jew. You rely on the law. You boast of your relation to God. You know his will. You approve what's excellent because you're instructed in the law. And you're sure that you're a guide to the blind, a light to those that are in darkness, a corrector of the foolish, a teacher of children, having in the law the embodiment of knowledge and truth. You then who teach yourself, will you not, you who teach others, will you not teach yourself? While you preach against stealing, do you steal? You who say you not must not commit adultery, do you commit adultery? You who abhor idols, do you rob temples? You who boast in the law, do you dishonor God by breaking the law? For it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. Instead of having an advantage over the Gentile nations, the Jewish morality had sunk to such a low ebb that they weren't any different from the people that they were condemning. They weren't any different from the Gentile. The stinking, filthy, and that's the way they looked upon them. The stinking, filthy, immoral, amoral Gentile who had no training, who had no background, who had no moral concept. And yet the Jew wasn't any better. Why? Well, I think that simply they lost these two concepts. They lost an awareness of God, not in name. No, no, they were very, very proper as far as whose people they were, but they didn't know who to whom they had belonged, really, or to whom they belonged. And they lost an awareness of what God really wanted of them, and they made it an external thing to where it never did really get down into affecting their real moral character. And as a result, they deteriorated. They rotted. From the inside out, they rotted and they crumbled. And the whole nation, Jesus said, unless you stop this way of living, you're going to perish just like these people that you consider so inferior to yourself in Luke 13 and verses 3 and on. That was why the Jewish people failed. They failed to be realistically involved and aware of God. They failed to be genuinely involved with an acceptance and an implementation of this thing, of this code of ethics that God had given them. And they failed because they failed in these two points. What about the Gentiles? What explains their moral depravity? Were they just simply wiped out from the very beginning? Did they not have any background? Did they not have any kind of an awareness of God at all? You know, they were really in foul trouble. People describe it, the historians, E. de Pressance, describes it as a sink of vice. The Roman and Greek civilization at the time of Christ was described as a sink of vice. And it makes you so sick at your stomach just to read about it. What was the matter with those people? Same thing. No, they had an awareness of God. The reason why I call this law before the law, it could possibly be described better as an awareness that existed prior to the written and verbal revelation of God to the Jewish people. There was this awareness. It existed in the book of Romans, chapter 2, verses 14 through 16. Paul speaks of this awareness that Gentile people had of a moral system of which they were aware. Now listen, when Gentiles who have not the law do by nature what the law requires, they are a law to themselves, even though they do not have the law. They show that what the law requires is written on their hearts, while their conscience also bears witness, and their conflicting thoughts accuse or perhaps excuse them on that day when, according to my gospel, God judges the secrets of men by Christ Jesus. That just simply says that the Gentile nations had an awareness of God and what he expected of them. Not only in the chapter 2 does he say that they had this moral concept or moral awareness, but in chapter 1, verse 21 and verse 38, or 32, verse 21 and verse 28, he makes the statement there and tells us precisely what it was that these Gentile people knew. In verse 21, he says that they knew God. That's right. I know that Romans also says that, or that in 1 Corinthians, it says that they did not know God. Through their wisdom, they didn't know God, it says. But this talks about another kind of wisdom. This talks about another possession that they had. These people, he says, though they knew God, they didn't glorify him as God. There's number one. They had this awareness of God. In verse 28, it says, they know the decrees of God. They know his law, that those who practice such things deserve to die. Two things the Gentile nations had prior to the coming of Jesus Christ. I don't know when they lost it to the point that there was no benefit in it for them. Somewhere along the line they did. But these people were morally degraded because of the fact that they had failed to maintain these two concepts. One, an awareness of the existence and the presence of God. And second, they failed to accept a tangible code of ethics by which they could make their lives work and by which they could become a moral people. And you have these statements in Romans, the first chapter, made in very, very, very plain language. But this is confirmed when you turn to the sources that are outside of the Old Testament giving of the law, that are outside of and separate from the giving of the Decalogue. Now, I want you to understand what I'm saying here. When you turn to sources outside of the actual giving of the Decalogue and the surrounding commandments, we find confirmation of this, that Gentile people knew about God and they knew about what was expected of them and how, as to how to live. Let me give you some examples of it. And I mean this, that's true also of extra-biblical literature. You can go to the Bible and find references to people who were outside the pale of the law as knowing God and knowing what was expected of them. You can go to materials outside the Bible and find this same awareness of God and this same awareness of what's right and wrong. Now, Romans 1, 21 and 28 are two verses of Scripture. They mention this thing of an awareness of God, and they mention this thing of an awareness of what God wants of us. These two verses parallel the division of the Ten Commandments. I hope you're with me. These two verses parallel the division of the Ten Commandments. The first three of the Ten Commandments speak of an awareness of God. The last seven of the Ten Commandments talk about the moral conduct of the people based on that awareness of God. Thou shalt not have any other gods before me. Thou shalt not make any graven image. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord thy God in vain. These three relate to this thing of knowing and being aware of God. His oneness, his holiness, and whatever the three relate to, these are informed, we're informed of these in the first three. The latter seven we're going to notice next Sunday. But I want to notice with you just briefly some what you might call extracurricular evidence that shows us that the Gentile people, your mamas and daddies way on back, your ancestors, they knew God and they knew what God expected of them. Let me give you some examples of it. Regarding the Gentiles' awareness of God, the Hebrew writings tell about these people. Balaam. Old Balaam. The New Testament mentions him also. The Old Testament has a very detailed account of Balaam's activities. Balaam was a man that lived about 1400 BC approximately. He was contemporary with Moses, with Joshua. He was contemporary with this age of the Jewish nation, the birth of the Hebrew nation. But Balaam lived near the river Euphrates at Pethor in the land of Amal. That's right. And yet, he was a man that knew something about Jehovah, and he was known far and wide as being a man who had some kind of connection with God that would make God listen to him. Listen, if you will. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed from with the fees for divination in their hand, and they came to Balaam and gave him Balak's message. And he said to them, lodge here this night, and I'll bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me. So the prince of Moab stayed with Balaam. And God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? And Balaam said to God, Balak, the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me, saying, behold, a people has come up out of Egypt, and it covers the face of the earth. Now come and curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to fight against them and drive them out. God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. So Balaam arose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, go to your own land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. Well, that sounds like a Jew talking, but it wasn't. This man was a Gentile, Jew and Gentile not being really distinctions at that time, but a man outside the pale of the Hebrew nation spoke of knowing God. God spoke to him. He spoke back to God in the sense of a revelation and a conversation. Well, where did he ever come into such a relationship as that with God? I don't know. But he had it. Well, I thought the Gentile nations didn't know anything about God. Ah, that's not right. Look again. Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, he's called the priest of Midian. That's found in Exodus, the 2nd chapter, verse 16. That's at the very beginning of it. When Moses met him, he was called the priest of Midian. He had so many daughters, I forget how many. In the 18th chapter and verse 16, I think, no, 18th chapter and verse 1, he's also called, again, the priest of Midian. And in that particular passage, and in the latter part of there, in about verses 10, 11, and 12, it says this, "And Jethro said, blessed be the Lord who has delivered you out of the hand of the Egyptians and out of the hand of Pharaoh. Now I know that the Lord is greater than all gods, because he delivered the people from under the hand of the Egyptians when they had dealt arrogantly with them. And Jethro, Moses' father-in-law, offered a burnt offering and sacrifices to God. And Aaron came with all the elders of Israel to eat bread with Moses' father-in-law before God." Well, now, Aaron had already been chosen by God to serve as in the capacity. The law was given after this, but Moses and Aaron had been selected by God to be the leaders of these people. And through them, God was going to reveal himself to the Israelite nation. Well, here's a man, though, separate and apart from them, connected by kinship and marriage, yes. And maybe that's where he learned about God, but it doesn't imply that. It implies that he knew about God beforehand, and that this concept of God and this awareness of God existed in the land of Midian prior to and contemporary with the existence of the same concept among the Hebrew people. Well, how do you explain it? Well, it can be, and it's very simple, I think. Here's another example of it. Job. Who was Job? Well, he was a man that knew God very intimately. In the book of Job, God describes him as his servant. Listen, there was a man in the land of Uz. He wasn't a Jew. This man was an Uzite. And yet he knew about God. How he knew about him. He was as intimate with God as any man, I guess, in the Old Testament. There was born 7 sons and 3 daughters. He had many things that were given to him from God. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord. And here's this story of how the trial of Job was set up. And the Lord said to Satan, "Have you considered my servant Job?" Now he was not a Jew. He wasn't an Israelite. He wasn't a Hebrew in this sense. This man was outside that pale. And yet God was aware of him, had said, "Have you considered him? He is righteous. He has no fault to be found against him." You see there? Here was an awareness of God, separate and independent of the revelation that God made to the Hebrew people. The apocryphal appendix at the end of the Septuagint translation of the Old Testament scriptures, the apocryphal or doubtful footnote, identifies Job with the king Jobab. He's referred to in Genesis 36 and verse 33, the king of Edom, and the great-great-grandson of Abraham. They say that's who this Job was. I don't know whether it was or not. But I do know that Job, according to the best authorities, lived about 2,000 years before the coming of Christ. And here was this knowledge of God, this awareness of God. Here's another example of it. Amenhotep, and this is outside the Old Testament writings. Amenhotep the IV. He was the last of the great monarchs of the great 18th dynasty of the Egyptian reign or rule. He lived about 1350 B.C. This man, I guess as much as any other man, could be identified as being contemporary with Moses and the giving of the law and this whole birth of the Hebrew nation and this revival of consciousness of God and of what was right. This man was a monotheist. He was not a polytheist. He was fighting for monotheism. He was a radical. He almost tried to establish it by revolution. He was defeated. But he was trying to get people to come back to see that there is but one God. Or he called this God Aton. But he wrote and in detail about him and tried to get people to come back to an awareness of the one God. Listen to this psalm that he wrote. "How manifold are thy works? They are hidden from before us. O soul, God, S-O-L-E, O, one God, whose powers no other possesseth, thou didst create the earth according to thy pleasure. While thou wast alone, men, all cattle, large and small, all that are upon the earth, that go about upon their feet, all that are on high, that fly with their wings, the foreign countries, Syria and Cush, the land of Egypt, thou settest every man into his place, thou suppliest his necessities, every one has his possessions, and his days are reckoned. Now, an Egyptian wrote that. An Egyptian who was aware of the one God, who didn't know really his name, but he was aware that there was a one God who was the creator, who made heaven and earth and all that in them is, and he lived about 1350 B.C. You say, well, why in the world are you telling us all these things? I'm telling you so that you can recognize that there were these spots or pockets of awareness of God and of what was right from the very creation of the world on down through to the coming of the law and then on the coming of Jesus Christ. There were these pockets of awareness among people that these people were not cut off from God, and he did not leave himself without witness. God has always made himself available to people. Now watch, somewhere along the line, this awareness of God and the awareness of what was required of men, we lost. Our ancestors lost them. And as a result, to the degree that they became unaware of God and to the degree that they became unaware of a tangible code of ethics, the morals of the world, the Gentile world in particular, I'm talking about today, the morals of the Gentile world deteriorated and rotted and corrupted. And were corrupted. And that's what the Bible says happened. In Romans, the first chapter, listen to this. And this affects every one of us. This is our history. This is our history of our people. Ever since, let me begin with 19. For what can be known about God is plain to them, because God has shown it to them. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible nature, namely his eternal power and deity, has been clearly perceived in the things that have been made. So they are without excuse. For although they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks to him, but they became vain in their thinking, and their senseless minds were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man or birds or animals or reptiles. Their concept of God shrank from the concept that Adam and Eve had and that Enoch had and that Noah had and Abraham, from the concept of the one God who is the creator of the heavens and the earth and all that in them is. From that concept, men began to deny God and say, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Though they knew him, they didn't honor him as God. And as a result, as they put him in the back of their minds, and I don't care whether it's through education or through television or through whatever may have been the process by which men just keep on shoving God back out of their consciousness. You don't push God out of your consciousness without an attendant result, and that attendant result is a moral depravity. And that's what we're experiencing today. These people were unwilling to be mindful of God, and as a result, their morals declined accordingly. Listen. Therefore God gave them up in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, to dishonoring of their bodies among themselves, because they exchanged the truth about God for a lie. And they worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. For this reason God gave them up to dishonorable passions. Their women exchanged natural relations for unnatural, and the men likewise gave up natural relations with women, and were consumed with passion for one another, men committing shameless acts with men. and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, that's the cause of the moral depravity. Since they did not see fit to acknowledge God, God gave them up to a base mind and to improper conduct. They are filled with all manner of wickedness, evil, covetousness, malice, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malignity. They're gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, haughty, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, foolish, faithless, heartless, ruthless. And it all came about because of the fact that somewhere along in the national history of these people, those nations that sprang from Adam, those nations then that sprang in a more multiplied sense through Noah, somewhere along in their national history, these people started saying, it's kind of poo-poo to think about God. It's old hat. It's out of style. It's out of date. We're too sophisticated. And professing themselves to be wise people, they turned into a bunch of raving fools. And their morals just went the way of all flesh. Brethren, how tragic it is. In this enlightened age in which we live today, we are governed in our educational processes, in our TV and communication processes, and oftentimes in our legislative, judicial, and executive processes, we are governed by people who, professing themselves to be wise, have become fools. And it comes whenever you refuse to have God in your knowledge. How tragic it is that we, as an American people, are having to bear the brunt of the folly of men who do not know God. That's where we stand today in America. I think we're lost. I think we're gone. Just like every other nation that left God, fell. How are you going to develop morals? There is no morality, friends, without an awareness of God and an acceptance of a tangible code of ethics. Next Sunday, we're going to notice the second part of this, the tangible code of ethics. But the basis of all of this is an awareness of and an acceptance of God. Do you have it? There is no other basis for genuine morality. Some of you here have not ever become Christians. You've flaunted God. You've rebelled against Him. You've put Him in the back of your mind. You know what kind of life you live. And if you think that you're living a hot-sitotsy life, then you need to look again and you're guilty of pride along with all your other sins. Without acknowledging God, you're lost. Would you like to come home today? Come back to God. Renew your acquaintance with Him. Renew your association with Him. Come home. Come out of the pig pen. Where are you? May God bless you as you think on the things we've said today. Let's take stock and see where we are and what we can do about it. If you need to respond in any way today, we hope that you will while we stand and sing.
I bring my sins to Thee, the sins I carry.